Great. So I'm about to give you a fabulous talk, as Beth said. So I'm from the Institute of Astronomy at Cambridge, and originally Vasily Belokurov was invited to come here and to represent Cambridge and try and stick up for itself. In particular, for example, the issue of the ultrafaint dwarfs that was mentioned earlier this morning, and to, like I said, maybe try and stick up for some of the results that they were finding there. So there's a bunch of people at IOA. I've probably forgotten some of them. But as well as Vasily, there's like Dan Zucker, who's done a lot of work on the ultrafaint dwarfs. And yes, you know a lot of those people already. Okay, so the outline of my talk. So I'm going to divide my talk into two parts. Firstly, talk about the general work that's been going on. And I've described this as being kittens in LEO, because there are a lot of these ultrafaint small things in LEO. So I'll talk about LEO 5, LEO T, and then I'll probably get into some trouble talking about Segway 1. And you can see here the logo that people constructed for the satellite factory, which was done because of the large number of these things that were found with Sloan from Cambridge. But given Scott's comments on the first day, maybe I should rephrase that, and it's now the stamp factory. So I'll actually be talking about my three favorite stamps from the Sloan survey. Then in the second half of the talk, I'm going to move on to work that I've been doing, which is looking at the kinematics of nearby stars, relatively nearby stars, using Segway spectra. Okay, so I'm going to start off by talking about some of these ultrafaint things. Now, this is one of the most impressive figures to come out of Cambridge in recent years, arguably one of the most impressive figures come out of the Sloan survey. And this is the field of streams that has already been shown. And so you see here some of the known features. So you've got the clear Sagittarius stream here with this bifurcation. Monoceros, you've got things like this bizarre Hercules Aquila cloud that's hiding behind a galactic bulge, and we don't really know what's going on. And then a lot of these small dwarfy things circled here. So what I'm going to do is just concentrate on three of these in particular. So the first one I'm going to talk about is, I believe, the most recent one, which is LEO 5. So here's the Sloan image. As has been explained this morning, you don't see a huge amount. But if you do a CMD mask, then you see the signatures pop out. You see this clear overdensity here. And then if you look at the Hess diagram, you can see the red giant branch and the blue horizontal branch around here. And so it's clear that there's something going on there. Now, one of the most interesting things about this this chap is the extent of the BHB stars. So in this figure, you can see the spectroscopically confirmed RGB stars, which are given by the black points here. This circle, I believe, is two half-light radii. And so these confirmed members are very tight in the center. Eagle-eyed amongst you might see that these two black points up here are quite bizarre. We're not entirely sure what's going on there. They're the right velocity. There's an estimate of the metallicity from some pseudo-equivalent width, and they're okay with that, and yet they are quite a long way away. But one thing that is undoubted is the extent of the BHB stars, which are given by these open circles here. And so they clearly go much further than what's seen in RGB stars. And so this kind of signature has been seen before in, for example, Hercules and LEO 4. And so it's interesting to try and figure out what's actually going on here with these things. There's issue as to whether there are RGB stars in this region and we're just not picking them up. But I think some of those were targeted for spectroscopy, some candidate members here, and there weren't any found. So, it's not entirely clear what's going on there. I think that was two half-light radii, I believe. It's published, the reference is up there, so I'm trying to check anything. And one of the most, another very interesting thing about this is the issue of whether it is actually a companion of a companion. So we already know, so this is LEO 5 here, and just below it here you have LEO 4. And the question is, what are the chances of getting two objects next to each other in this figure here? Now, if you just think about the 2D distribution, then it's not all that surprising. There's 20% chance that you're going to get two together here. But the fact is, Leo 5 and Leo 4 both have similar velocities and similar distances. And so the chances of getting that happening are less than 1%. So the question is this part of a stream? And so are we finding direct evidence for the issues of group info, which people like Amina and her group have published papers on, things falling in streams, or the issues of whether these things actually form in groups? Sorry, you mean this thing? What, this thing?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, yes. It's a reflection. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, Julio. You want to kind of cover up this thing? No. That. I don't know off the top of my head. Does anybody in the audience know that? Yeah, maybe 20. I believe so, yeah. I believe so.
How long
are you going
to watch?
Excuse me?
How long are you going to
watch? Me personally, I don't. But if you check the paper, you'll find out. There's there's those, I think, 4 or 5 RGB stars. And so I guess, that tells you. I'm not going to show anything else on Leo 5. Sorry about that. Okay. Now I'm going to make Oleg's life a little bit harder and discuss Leo T. So it's another one of these ultra-faint things. You don't see a lot. It's very far away, 420 kiloparsecs. And it's pretty wimpy, 3 solar masses. And this thing's interesting because, as the title of one of these 2 papers suggested, it's H1 on the brink of star formation. So Westerbork data shows that there's a significant amount of H1 in this thing. And you could say that. I don't know. Thank you for that. And so the question of star formation comes up for this object. And as Yelta showed on the first day, the match algorithm indicates that there are 2 populations. And you can see that directly from the CMD, which I'm showing here, courtesy of Dan Zucker's HST program that he's leading. And so we know that there's old stars because it's a bit of a mess, but the horizontal branches here. And so these stars up here are actually Cepheids. And there's arguably some RLIRAs down here. So we know there's an old population. And then there's all this blue stuff up here, which is indicative of a young population. So that's the evidence from the CMD. And then if it goes through these kind of algorithms, they predict that. Yes, I guess. Excuse me? Okay. Yes, yeah. So there's a bunch of Cepheids up here. Yeah. The question is, given the fact that it's got such a low mass, maybe it's surprising that it can retain gas and it can form stars. And so this object is in an interesting region of parameter space. I mean, it's a long way away, so if it was any closer, the gas would have been stripped. And also, because it's so far away, it's unlikely to have accreted a lot of gas. So, it's a very curious object. Okay, now I'm going to move on to the issue of Segway 1. Now, let me take a drink before I start this. So, as Marla alluded to earlier, there's conflicting debate about whether this is actually a dwarf galaxy or a star cluster. And in the original paper, it was postulated to be an unusual extended globular cluster. So what I'm going to do now is present the results of Martin Niederste-Ostholt, who's in the audience there, waving his hand currently. And so if you disagree with any of these results, don't shoot me, I'm just a messenger. Take it up with him over there. He's not my grad student, so... And Vasily's not here to defend him, so I'm sorry, Martin. Right, so anyway, what do we see here? We see the overdensity in the central regions here. Note the scale is like a tenth of a degree. And then a clear signature in the CMD here. So what Martin's done is he's applied the optimal filter technique, which was used, for example, by Odenkirchen to pull out the tails. I think it was PAL 5. And so basically, that's just using CMD filtering to try and pull out the low-level signatures of any extension in the photometry. And so what you can see here is that's the central regions of Segway 1. It looks a lot fatter than on the previous image because you have to do a lot of smoothing to pull out the low-level features. But what you can see is that these extensions here go out to as much as a degree. So if this was a dwarf galaxy embedded in a huge dark matter halo, then you would not be expecting to see things like this. Now, if you check out Martin's poster, there's some more details on this, in particular looking at the shape of the CMD in this region, and indeed it does look very similar to the CMD of the central region. If I can just clarify one thing on here, this is, as we said earlier, this chap is sat on top of the Sagittarius stream. So all of these kind of lumps, we believe to just be because of Sagittarius. So if you look at the CMD of, for example, this lump or this lump here, the CMD doesn't look like the Segway 1 CMD. That's correct? Martin nods. But there's a question from the audience. Yeah. Yeah, no, you don't. That's correct, Martin? Yeah, but you don't see the same level of... And hasn't Vasily done that and said that you don't find this level of noise? That's what he told me, but there's another piece of evidence. Let's not move on. Right, so Martin, correct me if I'm wrong, you believe that this kind of feature here and this feature here, yep. And you're not sure about this feature down here. That's correct. So like I say, if you check Martin's poster, we actually show the CMDs for these boxes around here. So you should check those out and then come to your own conclusion. But there's a final slide I want to show on Segway 1. And this is new results. So here's Segway 1. Here's the Sagittarius. So we know it's sat on top of Sagittarius. These two branches here are the leading arm of Sagittarius, and here's the velocity signature. So what we've done, or what Vasily and Martin have done, is they've taken a slice here at constant right ascension and are tracing the velocity signature of the BHBs along declination here. So in fact, you can't actually see the lines very well, but it's just this. I guess it's like 10 degrees or so. And so if you plot the velocity signature of the BHBs, you see here clear signature of the leading arm of Sagittarius, which is what you'd expect. Maybe a peak here and maybe a peak here. There is this gradient here in declination is because where we're looking in the sky, this is basically galactic longitude. So we're looking at the projection of the LSR. So that's why there's this offset. And then maybe here there's, perhaps it's Virgo, perhaps it's some disk stars. But what's new from this plot and what hasn't been seen before is the kinematic signature of the trailing arm of Sagittarius in this region. And so if you look here, it almost perfectly lines up with the velocity that Marla presented this morning. So we think that's fairly strong evidence that Segway 1 is actually a star cluster that was part of the lead, it got stripped from Sagittarius as part of the trailing arm. And that's why it has the same velocity. I mean, all the different models of Sagittarius predict that there should be the trailing arm somewhere around here. I mean, the offset on whereabouts you get the velocities. But that's just a question of shifting these things in right ascension. But what we've shown here is clear kinematic signature of the trailing arm, which kind of ties down these models. But now I'm going to get complained at. Yeah. So you're on about this offset here. Yeah, so this offset is about 10 degrees. And then you can see that the arm itself is about 10 degrees. And also, you have to worry about the spatial sampling of the Segway velocities, right? That's not homogeneous. And another complaint... Yeah. So, hold on, let Martin answer that question. Do we know which wrap of the trailing arm this is? I mean, it's unconstrained, but we're showing this signature here of the velocity, so we know that there's something going on there. But then, would the two wraps not have similar velocities? I mean, if you look at the trailing arm, they've got similar velocity. Well, okay, so we're using the prior that we expect there to be some trailing debris there. So if you want to check the comparisons of this with Mike Fellhauer's model, as Martin was saying, that's discussed in his poster. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I guess there was gas. The hypothesis is that there was gas associated to the cluster, and then the gas gets stripped, and then it slowly dissolves. Now, does that in any way answer? Okay. Yeah. Excuse me? Very low. So, well, I think the ways to test this are, firstly, to look at the velocities in these kind of extended features. I mean, if we see that those velocities are consistent with Segway 1, then the people are nodding their heads and they begin to worry. And also the metallicity distribution. If it's a cluster, you'd expect a tight metallicity distribution. If it's a dwarf, maybe it'd be more diffuse. So those are two things that you can do to test this and to finally come to a conclusion. But I'll leave the final word on the matter to a well-respected American journal, and that's Fox News, which says quite clearly here that it's loaded with invisible dark matter. So who are we to argue with the mighty Fox News? Okay, so I'll rush through this before I get deported and talk about... In the last 10 minutes, I'll talk about the work that I'm doing, so you can complain at me. And this... is one of the Sloan stripes called Stripe 82, and it's 250 square degrees along the equator, plus or minus 50 degrees in right ascension. And so it was monitored repeatedly with up to 80 epochs over 8 years, primarily to do work on supernovae kind of things. But obviously, this is a fantastic resource for doing photometric variability studies and also proper motion studies. So what we did in this paper up here, led by Dan Bramich, is we constructed this catalogue. And from this, you get about 1 million stars with photometric and astrometric information. And from this, we get pretty high accuracy with 7 times 10 to the 5 objects with proper motion less than 5 milliarc seconds a year. So the plot here is a reduced proper motion diagram. So you use the proper motion as a kind of proxy for the distance. And so what you can see here is a big clump of disk stars, disk dwarfs, and then offset from the disk dwarfs are the halo stars here, offset because they have larger tangential velocities. And then down here you see a cloud of white dwarfs. The white dwarfs have already been analyzed by Simon Vidry in his 2006 paper, where he found a bunch of these interesting ultra-cool white dwarfs. So now I'll talk about some work that's ongoing with this sample here. So what we've done is we've cross-matched with Segway spectra and Sloan spectra to get ourselves 12,000 disk and halo dwarfs out to about 5 kiloparsecs. So our distances come from the photometric parallax relation of Jelko Ivzic and his crowd. And so that gives us distances with about 10% error. And that gives us velocities about 25 kilometers per second error. And so what we want to do with this is to investigate issues of disk heating. And so what I'll show you now is just a few preliminary plots from what we're finding. And so here we have the dispersion in VR, here the dispersion in VZ is a function of height from the plane, color-coded with metallicity down here. And you can see the correct trends that you would expect, which is the more metal-poor stars are showing greater dispersions, and then as you go away from the plane, the dispersions are increasing. You can see that in both of the plots here. And if you extrapolate these metal-rich stars back to the solar neighborhood, you're going to get values that are consistent with the Denon and Binney work using the local Hipparchos stars. There's some issues with halo contamination. What we do is we take the counter-rotating stars and we use those to normalize the halo contribution. So then we can subtract the halo contribution to work out the dispersion of the disk stars. So that's what we're doing here. And so what you can do is also look at the ratio of these two dispersions, and that's shown in this plot. And it's fairly constant with a trend in metallicity. You could argue that this point here is offset, and that's probably just due to this halo contribution that we're maybe not correcting for properly. The value here we get for the most metal-rich sample is about 0.6. This is VZ over VR, the dispersion of VZ over VR. And so that's similar to what have been found in local studies such as the Geneva-Copenhagen survey and similar to theoretical expectations. So the final plot I'll show from these disk stars is the lag in Vphi as a function of Z height from the plane. And so again, you can see that as you move away from the plane, the lag increases, and the most metal-rich stars have the smallest lag, and the metal-poor stars have the largest lag, as you'd expect. So this is work that's being led by a student of mine, Hannah Whiteoak, and we're currently writing this up, and as you can see there, trying to do some interpretation of these results. Okay, so in the final few minutes, I'll talk about work on the halo. So doing some of the things as before, cross-matching with the Sloan spectra, we find we have around 2,000 halo stars. So we obtain our halo stars by doing a cut in the reduced proper motion diagram, which is shown by this region here. And this gives us, when we analyze the velocities for these things, it gives us pretty small dispersions. And also, we don't find any signature of any net rotation or any rotation gradient as you go away from the plane. But one thing we'd like to do is to look at the tilt of the ellipsoid. So as was mentioned earlier this week, Andy did some work looking at whether the tilt is vanishes in the plane of the galaxy. But we're now looking out of the plane by up to 4 kiloparsecs from the plane. And the question is, does the tilt vanish? And the answer is it vanishes for VR and Vphi, and it vanishes for Vphi and Vtheta, but not for VR and Vtheta. So this is spherical coordinates, so this v theta is approximately vz, right? And so what we see is this kind of 3 sigma detection of the tilt. Now, we were hoping that this would be 0 because it makes it a hell of a lot easier to interpret, because if it's 0, it implies that the halo potential has to be spherical. The fact that it's not 0 makes it slightly more harder to interpret. So here's a schematic of what we're seeing. And so we're finding this kind of orientation here. So we believe that this is not... If the halo was oblate, then maybe it would be going the other direction. So we don't believe that this is evidence for it being oblate. Maybe it's prolate, but then the other thing that you're all going to be worrying about probably is the galactic disk. Maybe the potential of the disk is going to be affecting this tilt of the ellipsoid. So that's something that we're now trying to quantify. I say we, Wynne Evans is trying to quantify this now. And hopefully when I get back next week, he'll tell me what the answer is. Okay, so I have 4 minutes to talk about the overdensities in the kinematics of the halo stars. So what we have here is a plot similar to what Heather was showing yesterday. But after pissing off Oleg and pissing off Marla, I'll now piss off Heather by saying I've actually flipped my axis here. I don't like left-handed coordinate systems, so... The sun is actually down here, the solar velocity at minus values here. Anyway, so what we have, these contours indicate the kinematic bias that we're suffering from because we cut and reduce proper motion. What we do is we can smooth this and correct it for bias. Excuse me? So on the x-axis we have jz, and this is j perp, which is the magnitude of the other two components of the angular momentum. Sorry. So we've smoothed it, and then what we can do is we can subtract off a uniform halo. And that pulls up lots of signals of substructure. The most significant are these two, which you should ignore. It's just because they're in very low efficiency regions and they've been overcorrected or undersmoothed, depending on how you look at it. The next most significant feature is this thing up here, which is the stream that Amina identified in 99. And we're finding this to a similar degree of significance as to what was seen in the recent paper by Kepley. So we find that maybe 5-6%, although there's uncertainties on that because it depends on the correction. Yeah, so I don't know how to quantify this in terms of sigma, but...
So how do you know anything about
sigma? Because we can... So for an individual detection like this stream here, we can look at how many stars our smoothing model predicts, how many stars we find, and then we can do statistical tests on that. And you're going to ask me for a number, aren't you? I can't remember the significance of this or this, but I mean the binomial probabilities of things like this or this are less than 0.1, I think, like 0.01, that kind of hand waving. But so once we've finished with this overdensity, we have an overdensity here. What's that? I mean, I think that's slightly new. And one thing you can do is overplot the globular clusters. So this is really the data taken from this Dinescu paper in 99. And so you can see that there are these four globular clusters potentially associated with this overdensity up here, one of which, NGC 5466, is known to be tidally disrupting. And if you integrate the orbits, it's predicted to come within the solar neighborhood. So maybe these four things are associated. Maybe it's part of some larger system that was accreted. We're currently looking into that. And then, excuse me? These three things. Yeah. But it's just the fact that we see this concentration of stars up here and the globular clusters appear to lie on it, so we're now going to investigate. So like I say, if you look at this thing, we know it's disrupting, its orbit indicates it comes to the solar neighborhood, so we know. I don't know the answer to that question yet. Also, this chap is also believed to be disrupting, and it's maybe arguably close to this. So we're currently investigating this and trying to figure out the significance of these things and whether they are associated with globular clusters. Okay. And so that brings me, in my last 30 seconds, just to pull up the conclusions. So I'd like to argue that we found some new and interesting satellites are still being found. And so that despite the fact that it could be labeled as stamp collecting, we're still learning things about the underlying physical processes from these stamps. And then the issue of Segue 1, it's important to know whether a stamp is actually a stamp or not. And then finally, I showed in the second half the work on the kinematics. So we're probing distances out beyond something like Rave, which is good for up to like a kiloparsec or so. And so it's a complementary analysis that we can try and tie these two things in to see if the actual global picture is matching. And finally, I've said that the future prospects for short baseline high cadence proper motion work from things like SkyMapper and PanSTARRS is it's going to be an exciting future, I think. And that's the end.
Thank you very much, Martin. And I feel pretty happy. I don't know if anyone's actually ticked off. Everyone seems pretty happy to me. And I think it would be great if we could maybe start off the discussion maybe a little more focused on the second half, just because Segue got a lot of discussion during the talk, and that's some new stuff. So if anyone.
I was just wondering how come you, it was clear, why you used TRIP82 for your disk kinematics, but how come you didn't just use all of the proper motions, using USNO, for example, and getting a much, because you can get way more halo stars that way, and, so Mario Andy and I are.
So it's a sample that we constructed, and so we like to
already
got a handle on what's going on there. Okay. We've got a hand on the systematics, and so we thought we'd start there. We've got 250 square degrees. That's enough to start off with. And also, I should say that there's prospects of possibly improving the catalog, because that was done in an arguably sloppy way. And if we do relative astrometry, we can get a factor of maybe 2 or 3 improvement in the proper motions. So then that would be better than whatever else you're going to get for the rest of the sky at the moment.
Heather? Martin, why did you need to use reduced proper motion to find those halo stars? Why couldn't you have just used the pipeline metallicities?
Yeah, we could have.
Because then you wouldn't have had all those nasty kinematic selection effects.
Yeah. But I mean, if you put a cut on metallicity like you did, then you reduce the size of the sample.
Yeah.
So we've got a large
you
sample.
You do that with reduced proper motion, too.
Yeah, but if you cut on reduced proper motion, we've got a larger sample than if we did the cut on metallicity that you were. If you do a strict cut on metallicity.
So it's minus one.
Yeah.
Mario, and then Warren.
Yes, Martin. So I'm wondering what the average distance to your halo stars is, the ones you select from proper motion diagrams, reduced proper motion diagrams.
Yeah, so the full sample, the average distance is like 2 or 3 kiloparsecs.
Because what we found is that after you go above 2 and start moving towards 3 and such, reduced proper motion diagrams become problematic because you have gradient in the disk rotational velocity. So you tend to mistake in most star more of the disk stars for halo stars, so it's kind of one thing to be careful about.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the distribution of angular momentum, we don't see disk stars in there. And if you look at the UVW velocities, very few are consistent with the disk velocity.
And you looked at metallicities are consistent with the halo.
Yeah.
So I guess to follow up on that point, stars that 2 kiloparsecs, 3 kiloparsecs off the disk are dominated in number density by the thick disk stars. So I guess it seems to me you might worry about contamination from thick disk.
Yeah, no, sorry. When I say disk, I mean thin, thick, whatever. We believe that it's free from contamination from the thick disk.
So, yeah, so I studied this in my
you can put in a kinematic cut, which I guess is what that, second line is, the dash line, which is well away from the disk, and then you just have to put it into your selection when you're analyzing everything.
So like I say, you look at the UVW velocities, we're fairly certain that the contamination is low.
But you got dispersions that were, a bit smaller than mine, and your proper motion errors are a substantial part of your velocity. So do you think that it's possible that it's due to a misestimate of the errors? Do you think you understand your errors quite well?
So I believe the errors on the proper motion, yes. Errors on the distance, maybe you could argue there's some scope in there.
How did you get your distances?
Excuse me?
How did you do distances?
This is the Jelko-Ivzich parallax, automatic parallax relation.
Oh, but aren't those not valid for halo stars?
Mario would like to hopefully stick up for me.
So the question is, are the Ivzich color magnitude relations valid for halo stars?
They are, because the latest Davis et al. Paper, the ones that Martin's been using, with the relations are calibrated as both functions of color and metallicity. So we know what, I guess what you're using is, do you use metallicity from
sample? Yeah.
Right. So if you know metallicity, if you know the colors, you should get the distances to about 10% or so. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. So.
Yes, my question is about Leo T. So you said that it's a galaxy on the brink of star formation, or like some H1 cloud on the brink of star formation. So what do you mean by brink? Because I think there's very little known about star formation, Kennicott relation, and dwarf galaxies.
I believe that refers to the fact that these souls are small and wimpy. Is that not a surprising issue, the fact that something that small can retain gas and form stars?
I'm just saying, how do you know that it's about to form stars? I mean, we have plenty of examples where gas is sitting, H1 gas is sitting on the outskirts of galaxies doing nothing for billions of years. So.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's gone beyond the realms of my understanding of Leo T.
But then it's not on the brink, it's always a brink.
And how young are the youngest? Like a giga year, a couple of years?
I think the estimates from the color magnitude diagram are more like 100 million years, or that may be an upper limit, but I don't have the HST data or anything. So.
But I think, so Yelta used the HST, did you use the HST data, Yelta? Okay.
Would you mind putting back up the Leo 5, some of the earliest figures?
Yep.
I'm interested in seeing again where you showed the spatial distribution of BHB stars and then the tentative RGB members. So the BHB stars, those are purely selected by color in the SDSS?
Yep.
And so I don't know if this is, was it talked about in your paper? You said it was sort of ambiguous, the interpretation of this extended distribution. Do you have kinematics of any of those BHB stars? Is there any tentative association or lack thereof of those open circles with the Leo 5 object?
I don't believe we have kinematic verification of these. I don't know if anybody in the audience knows more than me. So I don't think so. I think it's just, like I said, photometric cuts. But it's been seen in the other objects, right? These extended BHB distributions.
Pardon?
It's been seen in these other objects, extended BHB distributions, so it's not entirely new.
But it's quite unusual, right? Because it's patchy, and there are these great empty splotches.
Well, so
splotches.
I think Vasily would probably say that these are maybe not related,
mm-hmm.
and just claim that these are, and just don't ask about these things.
So, yes, Connie.
You alluded to this earlier, but the filtering techniques that are used to find these things are definitely going to be differently sensitive to the BHBs and the red giant. So I think you need to look at before you decide that's significant, you need to decide whether it's just because you can find BHBs much further out because there's less field contamination. So
yeah.
That's a real possibility, I think.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Martin? Even on Segway, I'll accept questions. There's one in the back. Hold on a sec.
Is it my impression that is quite thick?
So down here, we believe that there's Sagittarius.
Yes.
Contribution, which kind
but
of
broadens. But between 20 and 22.
Excuse me?
Between 20 and 22, it should be nothing.
It should be thinner there?
Yes. The thickness typically is due to binaries. Do you have any estimate of any binaries, how much they are binaries into this?
Do the observational people in the audience who've looked at Segway 1 know anything about binaries?
It switched off. No, it's not as much.
Yeah, those are not. That's not a Sloan CMD. But what the plot doesn't show is what the photometric errors are as a function of magnitude. So it's hard to say what the actual thickness of the main sequence
is. I think that between 20 and 22, I think that the errors would be a couple of percent.
I agree.
So binaries is up to 0.7 if you have equal mass binaries. And for example, because I remember in global clusters, there is a cluster E3 that is, has a huge amount of binaries, and it's a cluster almost composed only by binaries, essentially. More than 80% of the stars are in binaries. I was just making a general question. Can it be that all these faint dwarfs like this one, Segway 1, is only composed of binaries? So this is why they are surviving, because the single stars already went away, so have been evaporated by the cluster, and what remains is just the core of binaries. In global cluster, this is the final fate. Probably, I don't know if it was... This is one, just the first example of this kind of thing.
So the stellar densities in these dwarf galaxies are far lower than in globular clusters, so you expect a lot less dynamical evolution of that sort. But we are worried about the possibility that our velocity dispersions could be thrown off by the possibility of binaries, and so we're planning to go back and get repeat measurements, you know, over a few years of the stars that we've already observed to see how much of a contribution the binaries are maybe making.
But the argument against these being evaporated star clusters is the metallicities. The metallicity of Segway is minus 3.3, and we don't see any globular cluster, any clusters with metallicities lower than 2.3.
Okay. Anyway, I would expect, I think it's a problem, the thickness of the color magnitude diagram, because anyway, okay, you cannot explain the thickness if there are only single stars. You cannot explain with the depth of the... they say that there is no spread, at least. You don't know yet, but the few that you have seems not to be enough. Yes, if there is internal spread, of course, but you don't explain.
So for Segway, we can only measure the metallicity for one star robustly. all the other ultra-faint dwarfs, we see internal metallicity spreads of up to half a depth.
Okay.
Yeah.
All of these points on the Segway 1 CMD are very good. I'll also just add something I think Martin said in passing, not to gloss over too much, but for something like Segway, which is old and metal poor and at a distance characteristic of halo stars lying in the direction of the Sagittarius stream, to really look at the stellar population of Segway 1, we have to find a way to figure out where exactly the halo stars are and where the Sagittarius stars are lying in there, because it's quite overlapping in color magnitude space. And it's lunchtime. Thank you again, Martin, and all of our speakers in this session.